You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, there's been a mood in the wind of late where things have been getting cheap and cheaper. What's going on?
We have seen an outbreak in the ETF fee war, which, by the way, has been going on ever since Vanguard was a company. And ever since the first ETF came out at SPY, came out at 20 basis points to sort of tie the Vanguard index fund, this ETF fee war is nothing new. But what was different was the intensity of this particular outbreak. And in fact, some people at Inside ETFs, the conference we covered a couple months ago, they thought the ETF fee war was kind of over. And right as I heard people whispering, like, oh, it's done, it's over, bam, there was a outbreak like I've never seen. We're talking about 10 different issuers or shots fired with about 20 different ETFs being affected. And it included everything from the big guys to the indies. It's all there. It was unbelievable and, you know, garnered a lot of news. It also garnered a lot of reaction. You know, I think deep down inside, you've got people in the fund industry are probably scared that no, this is really wild and scary for everybody's livelihood. Then you had some mockery. You know, what's next? Free steak knives. You know, that's always what you hear. One guy, when the first shot was fired, which was a zero fee ETF, one guy in my Twitter feed a couple days later said, "How long till they pay you?" And then,
and it turns out, yeah, not that long.
Yeah, a day later, he was, you know, there it was. So
that's right. Like, it went not only to zero, but it went below zero, due to the fact that one issuer basically started to pay you to actually hold an ETF.
Yeah, this was, I think, a place we all thought we were going to go, but I think most people thought paying you would be a couple years down the road. But the fact that it came so close on the heels of the zero, I think that's what, and then in between you had Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street all do their shots. Theirs are more like bombs because those are going to really affect some flows. But this was, I get, again, the most intense two-week period of the fee war that I've ever seen.
Joining us on this episode of Trillions is Rachel Evans to help us walk through this timeline of the great fee war. This time on Trillions, the race for zero. Rachel, always a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
When you saw this happen, and it kind of culminated in late February, what was your take on it?
Yeah, so I mean, as Eric kind of said earlier, like, we've been seeing this fee war developing over the last few years. In many respects, this is really nothing new. This kind of cut and countercut, particularly from the big three, BlackRock, Vanguard and State Street, has really been taking place for a long, long time. However, what struck me as kind of new this time is that really the diversity of players that kind of like suddenly wanted to have a crack at lowering price in order to either get attention and or lure assets. And it really seems that this has become something that is not just for a select few large issuers, but something that really everybody wants to have a go at. And I think it really speaks to exactly how important cost has become within the ETF market. You know, whether you're a retail investor putting in a few thousand here or there, or whether you're an advisor with millions or billions to allocate, cost has become something that issuers can't afford to ignore. They have to have something that they can show to those investors that says, hey, you know, if you get into this fund, yes, the strategy is good. Yes, we have a good brand, but actually it's also not going to cost you much.
But isn't this, I mean, this is a huge business problem when it's great for a consumer, like, great, everything's free or almost free. what does it mean for asset managers?
Well, that is the big challenge, right? I mean, if you are charging nothing for your funds, where do you make a profit? Now, for some companies, Vanguard, for example, has an interesting business model in which it isn't really working for shareholders. It's working very much for kind of, I guess, the shareholders in its ETFs. Whereas, you know, for other companies that are publicly listed, you know, they have shareholders that they are accountable to and they do need to generate a profit. So the idea is that if you cut to very, very low, you then either kind of manage to make it up by getting lots of assets into those funds, and a very, very low one basis point on $1 billion, for example, is better than 50 basis points on no $1 billion. So in that respect, you can make it up there, or you try and potentially upsell by having other products that, you know, do charge more that you can kind of move clients into once they bought those very cheap products. There are also a few ways in which you can try and make a no-cost fund sort of pay for itself. They're a little bit more technical, but tend to involve, you know, securities lending out the securities from within the fund for a fee, and then using that to offset the lost revenue from charging nothing.
Let me jump in here because, you know, the invisible hand behind all this is advisors. They switch to a model where they get paid as a percentage of the client's assets, as opposed to getting a commission from the mutual fund. So what that did is it kind of left mutual funds out in the cold, because now that you're getting a percentage of your client's assets, of course you want cheap stuff, right? But advisors may be creating a monster that may come back and haunt them, because if they're so cost obsessed to the point where they're going to drive the issuer's fees down to nothing, these issuers who can't sell a fund over 10 basis points may start looking at their 1% fees and be like, that looks like a good business to get into. And so advisors, for the most part, haven't felt anything close to what asset managers are going through with their fees. So you may find asset managers start to get closer and closer to the end customer and become advisors themselves. You've already seen it with Vanguard and Schwab. BlackRock's becoming like a technology provider to advisors to try to make money from them in different ways. And this is also, you know, when Fidelity did their zero about a year ago, since then, the index of asset managers is down 17%. And this is when the S&P is up 6%. So that's a 22% underperformance of stocks of asset managers. So you can see that Wall Street is really onto this. Even though the revenues haven't been hurt that badly because of the bull market, it's been nice for their assets and revenue. This is sort of them looking forward and saying, these companies are in trouble.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. You know, when we do get a bear market, given that things are already at this point where so many fund issuers have had to lower their fees towards zero, you know, that has been very much done on the basis that assets will continue coming into these funds and these funds will continue growing to allow them to make a profit. If we start to see a bear market, yes, ETFs may well become kind of a place where people can hide out and try and kind of ride out the storm. But it does make it much harder for those asset managers to keep lowering costs and to make a profit. It could become quite nasty when we do see that bear market.
Yeah, I mean, most people are calling for an intense period of consolidation, and I think a bear market may trigger that. In my opinion, you know, I think these brave souls in the ETF terror dome, as I call it, that are fighting Vanguard and, you know, losing limbs left and right, I think they will be rewarded in the long run. I think these companies, because they have organic growth, they have things people want, which is cheap ETFs. On the other side of a bear market, they may find themselves the buyer of some of these large asset managers that were brand names for years. So companies like BlackRock, State Street, Invesco, Schwab, I think their names could be around in 10 or 20 years. As much as the pain they're feeling now, they may be rewarded down the road in terms of growing through acquisition and getting scale that way.
Okay, I want to walk through this latest fee war and this two-week period that we've been talking about. What was the first shot across the bow?
So the first shot across the bow was really SoFi. This is the online lender. You've probably received through the mail various kind of offers to refinance your student debt. Well, these guys now have their own kind of like asset management type business where they're trying to encourage people to let them sort of invest their money on their behalf, as well as refinancing their loans. So one of the things that they're doing as part of that is that they are launching these two ETFs that are going to be zero fee, or at least zero fee for a certain period in time. The way they're doing this is rather than price the product at 0 basis points for the life of the products, they're actually doing a fee waiver. So the management fee will kick in potentially in a year's time. So this was the kind of like first real shot across the bow. This came out in late February, and it really shows, I think, kind of in terms of, you know, these different theatres of war, if you will, of kind of like how this price war is kind of being fought. This is really the sort of new entrants that kind of need to come into the market. They need to make a splash. And this is a way to kind of like get headlines and get people interested in their products, you know, when they don't necessarily have a background in asset management.
Especially when it has a younger audience.
Exactly. Absolutely.
A couple things on SoFi. I do think this one isn't going to become big business. I think they'll probably service their own clients with this product or these products that are zero. I don't know how many outside investors they'll get. A couple reasons. One, they're not that well known. You know, they're not a brand name like BlackRock or Vanguard or JP Morgan. The second thing is that the zero fee funds they're launching aren't pure beta or, you know, it's not like the S&P or the total market. They're actually a sort of a proprietary index that has a growth tilt. I think they think the millennial clients are more aggressive. And I get that. So, you know, unless you're pure beta, you're not going to get mass money. I mean, you're obviously looking for a smaller audience that way. So I don't know if that'll be big, but it certainly got the headlines. It's something that I think will have ripple effects. But beyond that, it is interesting that it shows that outside companies that have nothing to do with ETFs now have a quick way to launch a free ETF to serve their existing clients. Because there's been some calls that tech companies may get into this business. And SoFi went through somebody else's exemptive relief. So it's almost like they took this fast track to get it done. And you may find ETFs being issued to service small groups of clients, and that way they don't have to pay Vanguard or BlackRock.
I actually think that I kind of disagree with you. I think actually this is a really interesting strategy because you have a built-in audience and you've just got them basically out of their debt. And now it's like, hey, as long as we get you out of debt, do you want to help make money?
Yeah, but the question is, again, if you're looking at the big, gigantic sort of ocean of assets, is an advisor in Texas gonna put their clients' money in SoFi and have to explain what that is rather than say BlackRock or Schwab? You know what I mean? Maybe if SoFi grows and grows, but I just think this is a product for their own audience. That's it.
I actually think that's advantageous. But then the next day, the 26th of February, what happened?
So we've already just heard about the new entrants. This was really on the 26th, a case of the old established guard kind of like coming out with their latest round of fee cuts. This was Vanguard. Vanguard came out and cut by 1 or 2 basis points fees on about 10 ETFs. Of course, they didn't finish off that week necessarily and sitting on that. They actually came out and then cut a few basis points off another three big funds, including their S&P 500 fund. And that became the lowest cost S&P 500 focused ETF with that fee cut. So that was kind of a really interesting example, I guess, of, you know, kind of how I sort of think of, like, you know, the US versus the Soviet Union in this kind of price war. I mean, this is kind of like where the real sort of, you know, arms race is going on between Vanguard and BlackRock, BlackRock and Vanguard. The two tend to kind of like, they won't tell you necessarily that they're watching their rivals that closely, but they're very aware exactly
suspicious.
How they are.
Suspicious.
Yeah, there are some interesting timings on these things. So Vanguard very much came out and kind of like put down a sort of marker and said, you know, here we have the cheapest kind of S&P 500 ETF now out there. So that was kind of like an example, I guess, of perhaps more of the type of fee war that we've been coming to expect rather than the new guys.
And that's interesting because Vanguard hasn't been the cheapest in the S&P 500, right? They've struggled to kind of always be lower than anybody else there.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of an interesting one because, like, you know, you have all these broad stock market funds and Vanguard's always kind of been, you know, towards the top there. But it's very much been kind of this question of people changing positions every few months. You know, you've got sort of BlackRock and Vanguard kind of vying, like one's up on the other 1 month, like one's up on the other the next month. You've got State Street making a push to get into that space. Not so much with their S&P 500 fund, SPY. That's actually relatively expensive. But with broad stock market funds, they've also been in that space. And Schwab, which is a newer entrant into the space, has been incredibly aggressive at launching and cutting fees to actually be in that space and very much alongside BlackRock and Vanguard at the top there.
Yeah, this is King Kong versus Godzilla, right? So this is, and this will move billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. This is big boy stuff here. The Vanguard case is interesting because, and as what Rachel just described, we refer to as the core wars, because these are products that would make the core of your portfolio, which is where most of the money in America is, right? So when they cut one bip When IVV came out and went one BIP lower than VU back in 2016, IVV immediately doubled its rate of flows and became the biggest flow getter since then, and got separation from VU from 20 billion to 60 billion. Now VU comes out, cuts one BIP lower than IVV 2 weeks ago, and since then it's had its biggest week in flows ever. We can't prove that's related, but I wouldn't be surprised if you see VU get a nice bump out of this, because we've seen the power of one basis point in this case, especially in the S&P 500. But overall, the core wars are a rough, brutal place to be. But if you just take the four core ETFs from BlackRock and you compare them to the four core ETFs of Vanguard, those eight ETFs alone have taken in 25% of the inflows in the past 3 years, even though they only made up 18%-ish of the assets at the beginning of that time. In other words, that is where a lot of the money is flowing. Again, these are real assets that you know you see at the top of the leaderboard year in and year out.
I have to say, I really liked a stat that Bloomberg Intelligence had at the end of last year, which was that I think 97% of flows into index funds, when you look at ETFs and mutual funds, have gone into products charging less than 20 basis points. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that shows you kind of like quite how important it is to have a cheap product.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents. People who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Okay, the next turn of the screw happened on March 1st. Eric, what happened then?
March 1st was an interesting one. State Street quietly, this was in the shadow of Vanguard, I thought, said they were going to convert CJNK, S-J-N-K, which was a crossover sort of double B bond ETF they had that wasn't getting much traction because other products had sort of done better. They're converting it to a broad high-yield product. But by the way, they're going to slash the fee to 15 basis points. This was quiet, but in any other time period, you're essentially seeing State Street, a major issuer, come out with the cheapest junk bond ETF on the market, by a good measure, too. And we've seen that Deutsche Bank, I think 2 years ago, came out with HYLB, which was, at the time, undercut everybody in fees in the junk bond market because it was 20 basis points. So here comes State Street now, as of April 1st, is going to have a broad high-yield ETF for 15. I can't imagine this doesn't do well. It's a big issuer, and we've seen the power of cheap in the junk bond space. Most people who are traders are going to use HYG and JNK. They just want that liquidity. But there is a group of longer-term investors who are really going to respond to those low fees, and I think CJNK, let's look out for it in a year to probably have $1 billion.
I'm really curious, though, to see how Deutsche Bank and BlackRock potentially react to this, because there was a really entertaining, from my perspective, a little spat that kind of like flared up in this fee war. I think it was last year. It may have been the year before. Time is flying past. But basically, once HYLB came out and did kind of undercut the rest of the market, BlackRock came out with this new broad high-yield fund. I think the ticker was USHY. Does that sound right, Eric?
Yes, that's the that's the one that's like double the securities of HYG, but it's still broad and sort of market
exactly.
Beta.
Yeah. But anyway, they came out with that, so that was cheaper. And then Deutsche came out and cut the fee on HYLB to kind of undercut USHY. So I'm curious to see kind of like whether this 15 basis point sort of shot across the bow actually prompts BlackRock or Deutsche to come out and try and be the cheapest again, or whether they're prepared to take the fact that they've managed to get a decent number of assets into HYLB and kind of sit on that and assume that money will keep coming in now that they've reached that kind of landmark. Mark.
And what's interesting is what Spider's really doing here, and they've done it over and over, is in a way, mirror what BlackRock did, which was pretty genius back in the day. BlackRock was getting its lunch eaten by Vanguard. So it said, hey, let's, instead of, we know we got these liquid products that traders want, and they don't care what the fee is. Let's keep those there, and we'll come out with a core series. So they come up with similar products that do similar things, but they're way cheaper. They're priced at Vanguardian levels. So Spider is keeping JNK, which I think is 40 bips.
Sounds right.
And now they've got their sort of core series version with CJunk. And that's what BlackRock has with HYG and USHY. So a lot of these issuers are sort of getting with the program of, let's keep our liquid ones at the higher fee because traders don't care what it costs. And then we'll have these lower ones for these cost-obsessed advisors.
And what's this done? I mean, look, we're a couple shots into this full-on cost-cutting war here. What's the mood like by this point that you guys can kind of discern?
I think people are starting to sort of quake a little bit in their boots. You know, when you start to see kind of like this happening across such a variety of different products, it makes you start wondering, like, you know, you start looking over your shoulder. Who's next? Who's going to come out? Who's going to undercut which product? So I think there's a lot of people, you know, on the sidelines kind of talking to their fund boards, talking to others in the market and trying to get a sense of like where the right price is for their products at the moment. I mean, no fund issuer is ever going to tell you before that they come out and cut that they're thinking about cutting. It doesn't have a good ring to it. But I think there's a lot of kind of conversations going on behind the scenes as to whether this kind of like resets the dial for what you can actually ask for these types of products.
And are people seeing any glimpses of success? Because success would look like what? Inflow, right?
Well, to Eric's point, I mean, like VU, which did cut, that's the S&P 500 product that Vanguard runs, and that had a $4 billion plus week. Now, last week was a bit of an odd week for flows. It's what we call quadruple witching, which has a very nice ring to it, but basically just means that there's an awful lot of futures contracts and options contracts expiring around the same time. It can fuel some flows. There's some index rebalancings that happen then too. So it's a little hard to kind of like disaggregate the flows from all of that kind of activity. However, you know, the fact that this was a record week for the fund and it came, you know, just a couple of weeks after that fee cut does certainly suggest that they are seeing some early success there.
Okay, we're in early March. March 5th, March 7th, what happens?
So this is kind of like where things start to get a bit thematic. So we've kind of talking, so far I've been talking about kind of these broad exposures. So broad equity exposure or broad kind of like debt, high yield exposure. This is where the fee war starts to kind of like really sort of drill down into some of these more nuanced niche kind of products. So Defiance, which is a relatively new issue, comes out with a 5G focused ETF. So this is looking kind of at the next generation of smartphones and of communications. They're charging 30 basis points for that, which in the thematic space is pretty darn low.
The theme space is interesting. 30 bips, you know, that's like coming out with a broad-based ETF at like 4. I mean, that is extremely low. The average thematic ETF fee is 62 basis points. But even when you asset-weighted, typically you get to a number half that, but the asset-weighted average is 60. So a thematic ETF doesn't really need to go that hardcore. The problem is once a theme ETF hits, and if you charge like, say, 60, 70, BlackRock, Goldman, and these other big issuers are going to smell some money. They're going to come in and undercut you. So I think this is Defiance's way of spraying BlackRock repellent on the ETF. And just, I've seen this before. A lot of issuers will just look into the future and they'll go, you know what? The hell with it. Let's just go to where we're inevitably going to go anyway. And this way we can save ourselves all the trouble. So to me, that is just as interesting a shot in the fee war as any of the other ones, even though 30 doesn't seem nearly as low as the other ones. Relatively speaking, that's low, and especially low for such a specific thematic ETF.
It's an interesting one as well because, I mean, you do have very much that kind of like, you know, breathing on the back of your neck from BlackRock and State Street and Goldman. I mean, they've all launched you know, thematic products over the last year. So if you are a niche issuer that focuses on thematics, you are very aware of those kind of Goliaths in the room that kind of like are looking to step onto your turf. Yet at the same time, you know, one of the reasons that they're looking to step onto that turf is that they are able to charge higher fees for those products. It's something that helps offset from a revenue perspective the fact that they're cutting costs elsewhere. So there's this interesting dynamic whereby on the one hand, you know, you need to kind of like go low because it does act as BlackRock repellent. Yet to the other hand, BlackRock's coming into that space because they do want to be able to charge a fee.
And when you look at theme ETFs, you know, they are cheap. And this one's a good example. It charges 30 basis points. But we have this new score we're running in BI, which we call the thematic capture score, which looks at how much of the stocks actually get their revenue from the theme. And this one's very low, 36%. We've got other ones that are 80, 90. So this is on the low side. So in a way, again, this is a good reason to look beyond the fee sometimes, because if you're looking for 5G direct revenue, you're only getting a slice of it here. And the other thing is, it also shows that what I used to call VFZs, Vanguard Free Zones, where you could make a little money and, you know, buy some food and stuff, those are gone. Vanguard Free Zones, other people are now taking a page from Vanguard's book and coming in low. Goldman did it in Smart Beta a couple years ago with GSLC. And so the Vanguard Free Zone is almost a thing of the past. The only place left where none of this is really happening is in these high-octane leveraged ETFs, which charge 95, but no one's really messed with those. Outside of that, I mean, it's pretty much fee war on.
So maybe there is BlackRock repellent spray, but on the 7th of March, BlackRock also launched a cheap ETF specifically on Japan.
Yeah. No, so Japan ETF, they've had EWJ for a long, long time. It's pretty expensive. It charges 47 basis points. That's the expense ratio for that. They came out with a couple of Japan products that charge 15 basis points. So they are undercutting themselves. Now, these products are slightly different. One of them is equal weighted, for example. So it's taking a more kind of smart beta approach to the country-specific space. But it's interesting that in this war, they are even prepared to undercut themselves if it means trying to kind of get some market share. Interesting to me, they are not, however, the cheapest funds in the Japan space. There are other products that are out there that are 9 basis points, which does mean that potentially those are the ones that are kind of like vying for that you know, very, very fee-conscious investor. But it is interesting that they are trying to, I guess, similar to what they did with these core products a while back, they are trying to create a product that is cheaper and potentially appeals to the fee-conscious investor whilst keeping the product that has a lot of assets already and can afford to charge 47 bips.
This was also, I don't know if a response to JP Morgan. JP Morgan had come out with a cheap Japan ETF, BBJP, at 19 basis points, undercutting EWJ. And a lot of its own advisors moved from EWJ to BBJP, which brought up concerns of conflict of interest. Pushing that aside for a second, it's a whole other conversation. This is kind of a shot fired back, although it's equal weighted, so you are going to get a little more risk. It's not maybe for the same audience, but I guess BlackRock can now roll into a meeting and say, yeah, we have cheap Japan too.
They weren't the only ones to do something on March 7th. DWS did something in the ESG space.
Right.
What was that?
So this is the asset management arm of Deutsche. They rebranded, but it's always good to remember it's Deutsche. So they launched an ESG fund, USSG, that came in at 10 basis points, undercutting all the other ESG funds out there. And they did this because they had the help of a Finnish pension fund. So they already have 800 million of assets under management, which is very, very good for a new fund that often kind of dawdles at around 3 million. But basically, they are charging the least for an ESG ETF in the US. And it really shows, I think, kind of how, you know, not just in the thematic space, not just in the country space, but even within areas like, you know, environmental, social governance, social responsibility, fee is important. That potentially is an area where you could see investors more willing to pay up if they actually think that a fund represents their values or think that a fund is kind of, you know, sort of doing the right thing in terms of how it measures those criteria. But this is still an area where we are seeing that kind of fee reduction come through. And I think it just shows you how extensive this fee war really is.
And also, ESG had been the one space where we weren't sure back in the day whether people just didn't like ESG in reality or they just wanted it cheap. Now I think we're starting to see they do want ESG. They're just waiting for cheap products because Vanguard came out with a product for 12 basis points in the ESG space. That's already up to 280 million. That's not bad for less than a year old. And then you have USSG. So if you look at it, most of the flows now are going to ESG products less than 20 bips, which sticks to that whole 97% of the money likes to go into that space. So in a way, it's probably a good sign for ESG people because I think there was some – I mean, I was definitely – thinking that ESG was maybe more of a myth because had all this great press, all these surveys, and the assets weren't coming. But now we're seeing that maybe they just wanted it a little cheaper because we are seeing decent flows now into them if they're low cost.
All right. So this part of this 2-week moment was all about sort of thematic ETFs. And then things got crazy. What happened the next week? Because Schwab, JP Morgan, and then the harbinger of craziness, the negative fee ETF. What happened with Schwab and JP Morgan?
So this week really encapsulated pretty much everything that we've kind of been seeing. So JP Morgan, it's a relatively new entrant into the ETF space. It comes out with a 2 basis point fee on its products. Some had speculated that it could have been zero. We were slightly disappointed in that. But 2 basis points, still the cheapest ETF out in the market if you exclude those that are offering fee waivers. Interesting because JP Morgan, as this new entrant, has actually managed to double its assets over the last year. So this is something that has definitely worked for them. They have been able to undercut their competitors and gain market share. But that wasn't going to stand in the headlines for long. We had Schwab coming out and reducing small cap, mid cap and dividend ETF by 1 basis point apiece. Shows you exactly how much these little margins go. And then we had Salt Financial, a name that I don't think many people in the industry had come across before. They only had one ETF out there, coming out with something which totally changed the game, offering 50 cents for every 1,000 invested for the first year if you buy their ETF.
And so, just quick comment, Schwab always responds. We were waiting for them, and just on cue, they responded. They're famous for that, and they're all cheap. So, not a shocker there. JP Morgan, a little bit of a shocker. I thought that would be zero. It was 2. I don't know if it'll move the needle that much, because if you can get that kind of exposure, total market, for 3, and it's liquid, that's a tough sell, but we'll see. And then the negative fee one got a lot of eye-rolling, a lot of skepticism. I think it was... This really taps into the plight of the small issuer. What they're really doing is saying, and it's not a bad product. It's a low-vol product that charges 29 basis points. That's fine. That's reasonable. They're just waiving it and giving you 5 bips to help bring you in, because not many people want to be the first investor in a new ETF, so we'll pay you for that concern. And we're going to cover the wide spreads that a new ETF has. So I don't know. It's sort of representative of the hurdles that a new indie ETF has, and they're just addressing that in a common sense way. But it got, you know, people just, I don't know, their intuitions start to smell like some sort of a gimmick. But if you dig in, I didn't think it was that irrational.
It's a gimmick, but it might be one that we see again, because again, that moment that somebody launches, the problem is they don't have assets. So how do you get assets? Like, give them, incentivize them.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think I would say, though, the one caveat to all this kind of like fee cutting that we're seeing is that if you are already invested in one of these funds, there needs to be a reason. Potentially that reason is cost, but there needs to be a good reason to kind of shift from one to another. You know, when you sell a fund, you are obviously incurring various trading costs. You also may be incurring a tax bill if that fund has gone up over the past year. So when thinking about switching from something that maybe charges 20 basis points to something that charges 10 basis points, you need to kind of be aware of that. It may be worth it, particularly if you're going to be holding something for the long haul and you don't want to be paying that annual fee, but it's something to consider.
By the way, just as we end this, just this morning, BlackRock announced it was cutting the fee on its S&P 500 index mutual fund to 0.0125, which would undercut Fidelity by 75 one-hundredths of a basis point. So now that's the cheapest S&P.
Now we're just talking decimal points.
Yeah, it's that cheap.
So, and then there was some fee, some really low-cost ETFs being launched in Europe in the middle of all this as well. So this isn't really just relegated to ETFs. It's actually spreading to other fund types, other countries. This thing is not going away anytime soon.
Okay, well, step back for a second, and let's put a bow on this. What is the end game going to look like here?
Resounding silence. I mean, I think the end game looks something kind of like where we're actually at. I don't think that this is going to be a case where all funds end up cutting to zero or below in order to be successful. I mean, if you look at kind of the larger asset managers, you know, they have position in the market already. They do already have assets and they're going to look to defend this. There's no interest necessarily for them in cutting all of their products to zero. If they're doing well and gathering assets with something that charges 10 basis points, they're going to keep something kind of around 10 basis points. But for newer issuers that do want to make a splash, I think we will see a succession of those come out with zero or below zero kind of incentives to try and get those headlines. After a while, though, you know, people like anybody kind of gets bored of this sort of thing. So once it starts being kind of very commonplace, then people will need to think about something else that makes them stand out.
I agree with all that. I would maybe add also, sometimes when I see the vision of all this, I see it looking like the airline industry, where you have 3 big carriers basically competing on cost every day, giving you routes everywhere, and they control 75% of the market. I see a lot of consolidation. You have 3 companies which basically give you these core portfolios for nothing or 2 basis points. And then on the outskirts, you have these sort of niche airlines like, you know, Alaska Air or private jets. And those would be like alternatives, hedge funds, themes, innovative products that do certain specialized things. And those will be sort of sprinkled on the outside of the portfolio. And people will pay up a little more for those, at least for a while. Some of that will probably come down too. But I don't see anything stopping that future scenario. But the catalyst would have to be a bear market. A bear market would be what starts to reshape this, and the ramifications of all this organic growth going to stuff that doesn't charge anything will start to show itself in the market.
Rachel Evans of Bloomberg News, as always, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find Rachel at RachelEvans_NY. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.